Hey everyone, this is James Wilson with MTB Strength Training Systems and BikeJames.com, and welcome to another Bike James podcast. Got a bunch of good stuff lined up for us today. In the training section, we're going to talk about balance training for mountain biking, you know, different kinds of balance training, do they have uses, what's the best way to use them. In the skills training section, we're going to be talking about why dropping your heels on descents or dropping your outside foot in corners is a bad idea, and how they get you focused on the wrong thing and take away from your ability to execute your skills properly in those situations. In the bro science, we're going to talk about some studies that look at clipless pedals and how they increase the risk of hip injuries, especially when you crash and you're not unable to get unclipped. And so looking at the science that actually, you know, is not just an opinion that clipless pedals increase your risk of injuries. Now there's actually some science that backs that up as well, and just kind of talk about those and what that means. And then finally, in the rider Q&A section, I got a good question from a guy about studies that show that sitting down to pedal is more efficient at submax efforts than standing pedaling, and wondering why I recommend standing pedaling and push it so hard on people if the studies have shown that that sitting is more efficient at submax efforts. And so it's a good question. Had some thoughts on that. And so anyways, before we get started on that, a few just kind of things before we get started with the topics. I wanted to let everybody know that I'm going to have a new website coming out soon. It's been, near 10 years since I got the last update for BikeJames.com. And so it's definitely due for a facelift. You know, Bike James has grown a lot over the last 10 years. And so just trying to make it easier for people to know, you know, the different things, the you know, videos and podcasts and the different free workouts that you can sign up for. And then also the different workout programs that I have. And so just trying to make it easier for riders to find the resources that will help them improve their riding. So really excited about launching that new website. Should have that going here in the next week or two. With that, also wanted to remind everybody that a new workout of the month is now available. The first Monday of the month, I always send out a new workout. And so if you haven't signed up for that yet, you can go to BikeJames.com and just sign up for my newsletter. You'll get a workout sent to you right away. And then again, the first Monday of every month, I'll send you a new workout, and plus I'll send you weekly training tips to help you with your riding. And so you can go sign up for that. But got that available. And with that, I did make a couple changes. Wanted to just highlight a couple things. I've added a dumbbell/kettlebell workout. I know that I love steel mace training and ramping isometrics, but they're tools and methods that not everybody has access to. And so I just wanted to make it easier for people to be able to use the workouts. And so now you'll actually find two different workouts in the download. You'll have a kettlebell/dumbbell version, and then you'll have the ramping isometric and steel mace version. So if you've been doing that, we'll still have that. I've also added a follow-along warm-up and a follow-along decompression routine, so something to do after the workout. And then I also have a weekly training plan download that you can get as well, that will show you some different ways to put everything together, including your riding and your training and all the different things that go together into a good training program. So just wanted to let everybody know I've made some changes to the workout of the month. So if you had checked it out in the past and for whatever reason it stopped checking it out, then maybe you want to check it out again. I think that it's better now. I'm always trying to find ways to make these things better. Again, my goal with that workout of the month is to make sure that every rider has access to a good quality mountain bike specific workout, regardless of your ability to pay. I don't think that your ability to afford a workout should predicate your ability to have access to it. And so that but hope people enjoy that. And if you haven't checked it out, then hopefully go check that out. Wanted to also just let everybody know I'm going to a seminar this weekend, a BioForce coaches seminar. BioForce is the program put together by Joel Jamison, who is one of, if not the top conditioning coach in the world. I mean, he's widely recognized as one of the top conditioning coaches out there. He's consulted by, you know, professional teams in every sport. He trains a lot of UFC fighters and has worked in with combat athletes for a long time. And so I did his certification a few years ago. He's also the guy behind the BioForce HRV, which is now the Morpheus system, Morpheus HRV system, heart rate variability. I've talked about that in the past as being a valuable training tool for me, and recommending that people check that out as well. But he does a free workshop every year, and so for the coaches who've been through it. So he's got some cool presentations lined up. I'm going to go do some networking. And so by the time this podcast is released, I'll actually be flying back from the that seminar. But I'm excited to see what I learn and, again, make some cool connections. And it's in Seattle. I've never been to Seattle, so excited to go up there and check it out. See what else we got here on the list. All right, I've got Purple Pedals in stock again. So, yes, with Pedaling Innovations, again, that's my company that produces the Catalyst pedal, which is the world's first midfoot optimized pedal. And it, we've got the purple color back in stock. It's one of the more popular color runs that we've done in the past. We always get a lot of requests for it. And so if you've been waiting for the purple pedals, make sure you go to pedalinginnovations.com and jump on those, because we only got like 300 in stock, and we've already sold like 100 of those within the first week or two of getting them in stock again. So go check those out. And then finally, I just wanted to touch on a couple highlights from a clinic, a workshop that I did this past weekend on Saturday. And it was my air control clinic. And basically, the last Saturday of the month here at the Catalyst Training Center, I put on a free skills training workshop. And I have three basic ones that I put on. The first one is cockpit control. The second one is cornering control. And the third one is air control. And the one that we did this last weekend was the third one in the series, which was air control. And air control really revolves around the ability to perform a good front wheel lift. Like, that's the bulk of what we're working on, because that unlocks being able to properly lift your front wheel is the key to unlocking a lot of other things, including your manuals, your bunny hops, doing drops, jumps, a lot of skills. Basically, you know, your ability to manipulate your bike in a way to catch some air and do it in it with some style and balance. Those skills are unlocked by your ability to understand how to properly manual or, you know, do like a front wheel lift and just, you know, use your weight shifts to get the front wheel up rather than using your arms to pull up on the front end. And so I was really excited because I had six riders show up, and several of them had never been to one of my clinics before, and which was fine because I really kind of start all of them from the same basic spot, go over some of my theories and thoughts on riding and how to use your weight to manipulate the bike, which is really the name of the game. It's using your center of gravity in relation to the bike center of gravity to create weight on the front end and back end, and using those weight shifts to manipulate the bike. And that's what, you know, you're at the heart of the front wheel lift, is weighting that front end and then shifting your weight to the back end, and that weight shift pushes the bike in front of you and lifts the front end in a balanced way. And so everybody was getting a lot from it. It was awesome to see people who had really struggled with being able to lift their front wheel, or really hadn't been able to do it properly, all of a sudden being able to do it. And, you know, it was awesome to see. And they were really pumped because you start to see them realize what this opens up for them on the trail. Because there's a lot of stuff on the trail that if you can't do just a basic front wheel lift, just unweight your front wheel properly, and you just have to, like, blast into things, you know, it's a lot rougher. Or, you know, there's a ledge and you try to get up on it and you pull with your arms, and if you time it wrong and that front end comes right back down and stuffs into that, into the ledge, it can be scary. And so people start to shy away from those things after a bad experience or two. And so you could see that as people were getting the feel for it. They were getting excited. You could, you know, talking about, oh man, yeah, okay, now I can take a 2x4 and practice timing this to get over things. And it's like, yeah, you're starting to see how you can progress this basic skill into other things on the trail. But there was two take-home things for me that really stood out. And one was, you know, ironically, I've been trying to teach my six-year-old how to do a front wheel lift, or as he calls it, a popping in a wheelie. And it, you know, to a kid doing it, they're trying to muscle it up and doing it, and it's unbalanced, and you're like, oh man, you're going to crash doing that. So I was trying to figure out, how the heck do you explain this to a six-year-old? Because they're not going to remember the 10 steps of manualing, right? Like, it's got to be stupid simple for a six-year-old. So I broke it down to three things for him, and I found it really helped for the adults as well. The first thing was to stand up and stop pedaling. And that sounds self-evident, but you would be surprised, like, especially with him, he was doing it, and a lot of the adults were doing it too, where they would try to get up to speed while sitting down, and then they would stand up and try and execute the skill like almost in the same movement as they were standing up. Or they would stand up and they would be pedaling, and they would, you know, almost like not, they wouldn't stop pedaling for an instant. It would, you know, they wouldn't get control. And so, like, standing up and stop pedaling and getting your balance points in that position settled is the first thing you want to do. The second thing you want to do is put as much weight on your hands as you can. And again, this goes against so much advice out there. I was telling the people at the clinic that, you know, light hands and heavy feet is probably some of the worst advice that's ever been inflicted on the mountain biking world, because people really misunderstood what it meant and took it too far. You most certainly do want to have weight on your hands at times. And when you're about to do a front wheel lift, that is one of those times, because if you don't get yourself and your weight in front of the bike, how can you push the bike in front of you? And so most people don't really get in front of the bike. They get kind of on top of the bike, but they're afraid to weight their hands. They don't let their hands get heavy. And so by telling my six-year-old kid Z, hey man, put as much weight on your hands as you can, you saw him load up the front end and get heavy on the front end. And then I told him, lean back as hard as you can. And he do it, and boom, you know, front wheel lift. And he's getting better at it. It's getting a little higher. He's doing it in a more balanced way. And but when he does, when he strays from those three things, stand up and stop pedaling, put as much weight on your hands as you can, and then lean back as hard as you can. And when he strays from those three steps, things start to go sketchy for him. And I noticed that same thing with the adults. That same advice applies to the adults. Stand up and stop pedaling, weight your hands, and then lean back. And obviously there's details that you can get into with those steps and in between those steps and all of that, but those three basic steps are it. Like, that's how you boil down a good front wheel lift, how you unweight and lift your front wheel in a balanced way. And the other thing that I noticed, I took away from it, was how much wide handlebars takes away from your ability to do that effectively. And what really highlighted this was one lady in particular who was, who was relatively short. She was like 5'3". You know, my wife's 5'4", so, you know, I'm not, I love short people too. But, you know, she was on the shorter side. But her handlebars were ginormous. They were like 32 inches wide. And so you had this tiny person with the widest bars. And again, she had been sold these bars based on, man, the wider bars are going to increase your leverage. They're going to increase your stability. They're just better. If you take your handlebars in, you're going to be a mess on the trail. You're going to have trouble controlling your bike. It's going to be unstable. You're just going to be getting tossed around. And so, you know, she was, in practicing the manual, she was unable to lift the front wheel. She was the only person who was unable to do it, because she was the only person who had like that extreme difference between how her size and the handlebar width. Other people had really wide bars, and I could see that it was affecting them, but they were still pulling the skill off. But this lady could not get the front wheel up to save her life. And I was thinking, like, well, you know, she is a little small. maybe she just doesn't have the weight, she doesn't have the power. And, you know, she's talking to me and I'm looking at these giant handlebars that she's got. And I'm like, I think that your handlebars are too wide. Like, I just have to say, just knowing what I know about, you know, hand width and how it affects your ability to create and transfer force through your hands and all of these things, that your hands are just so wide, you're not able to transfer the force into your bars effectively. And so my wife was at the clinic and her bike was the same, you know, similar size as hers. But my wife has handlebars that are 26 and a half inches wide, you know, almost 6 inches narrower than what this lady had on her bike. So my wife let her borrow the bike and she jumps on the bike. And sure enough, the first time she tries it, the front wheel comes off the ground. And she is doing front wheel lifts with no problem using the exact same technique. The only difference was the handlebar width. And I wish I'd gotten a video of it because it was such a dramatic demonstration of how much your wide handlebars restrict and affect your movement on the bike. And that the push-up test is, and I even have a modified one that I'm going to be coming out with and sharing with you guys soon. But it's basically you take a freaking broomstick or stick and you put it on a yoga block and do a push-up like that. And then measure where your hands are. And that's how wide your hands should be on the bike. And I guarantee you that for most people, it's going to be like, you know, 720, 700 millimeters or less. And that, you know, bars is 780, 760. Man, unless you are a giant, like 6'5", they're too wide for you. And they are affecting your range of motion. This is something I'm going to be doing some, you know, some videos and really trying to highlight for people, because once you see it, you realize like, oh my God, like these things are ridiculous. They're restricting your movement. They're making you less stable, not more stable. And so yeah, just kind of like I said, it was an interesting highlight. That lady was definitely going and cutting her bars down as soon as she left that clinic, because there was no denying that her ability to control her bike and maneuver her bike was increased with that. So anyways, I was excited about that. So that was, and if you're, you know, again, that was the free workshop, the free clinic I did on Saturday, last Saturday of the month. If you're in the area, you're welcome to check it out. CatalystTrainingFruta.com is the website for the facility here. And we can, you know, yeah, I've got some different workouts and stuff I do here. So check that out if you're here, either visiting or live around here. I'd love to see people here. So, all right. So that was kind of a little mini subject, I guess. I didn't really expect for my air control highlights to go that long, but I thought it was some good stuff. And like I said, I was excited to share some of those things with you. Just some of my insights into helping people execute that skill more easily. And again, if a kid can do it, right? If you can coach a six-year-old to do it, then it's stupid simple. And that's really what you want, is you should be able to coach it to a kid. And if you can't, then it might be too complicated. At least that's what I strive for. But anyways, so getting into the rest of the subjects here. So training. For the training for mountain biking subject or section here, I was going to talk about balance training for mountain biking. And this comes up from time to time. And one of the reasons it's been coming up more, I think, is because there is a young lady named Kate Courtney, I think is her name. And she is the current world champ, definitely like one of the top U.S. riders. Again, I have to apologize. I'm not super up on the racing scene. It's just it's just not my scene. So I'm aware of who she is and she's really good. But her specific credentials escape me at the moment. But what she does do is post a lot of her workout videos to Instagram, which, you know, a lot of riders, especially of this generation, do. And she's really well known for doing plate flips while standing on Bosu balls or balance boards, basically standing on some sort of unstable surface and then holding a weight plate. And then flipping it, like, you know, tossing it so and catching the other end, or, you know, sometimes tossing it more, but doing these plate flips while standing on a balance object, like I said, you know, Bosu ball, a Swiss ball, an endo board, you know, there's all sorts of different things. And so I think that that's probably one of the reasons that I'm starting to get more questions from people about balance training for mountain biking. It tends to come and go in waves. and it usually corresponds with somebody posting something and you know, helping to repopularize instability training and the Swiss balls and the balance training aspect. And so, you know, this stuff's been around for a long time. I remember, you know, man, back, what was it, the late 90s, I want to say, was when like Swiss balls kind of first hit the scene and became popularized. Like Paul Cech was a, you know, old school strength coach dude who's still out there. Really great dude. If you've never heard of him, you should check his stuff out. But he was the guy who really helped to popularize Swiss balls in the modern fitness world. And before that, no one had ever heard of these things. No one had ever thought about doing balance training. You know, to us, instability training was switching from bench press to dumbbell bench press. Right, like that was it. And so it was definitely a new world, and I got bought in on the stuff like hook, line, and sinker. I went all in. I had all the different size balls. I did most of my training on the stuff. I could squat on the ball, you know, holding weights. I was doing weighted squats on the ball, a lot of stuff, you know, doing this balance training. You know, they also talked about how it worked your stabilizer muscles. You know, there was all these different reasons given for why this was good stuff. And I can tell you my own experience, I didn't notice it doing much of anything for my mountain biking. I didn't feel that it was actually improving my riding. If anything, I felt like I was actually getting weaker because I was constantly lifting less weight because I was always on some sort of unstable surface. And so with the athletes that I've trained, I've kind of found the same thing. I've used Swiss balls. I use some instability training, but it's very minimal. And I really don't like to mix it with weights. And I definitely don't like to mix it with weights and acrobatics where you're doing like plate flips. And so, you know, just, you know, one thing, you know, to kind of address that exercise specifically, you know, you always have to run things on a risk to benefit ratio, right? And so the risk to benefit is the benefit that you're getting from that exercise, that movement, worth the risk. And for me, I don't think that, you know, doing that for fun, like maybe if you're like, dude, this is like a fun little challenge that I'm going to do, you know, and you try it and it's like, you know, you're kind of prepared to fall and you're, you know, ready. And it's like, ha, ha, ha. That's one thing. It's another thing to use it like an exercise and be like, this is actually helping me become a better rider. And there's so many other things. You know, you got to remember pro riders. I had a video that I posted. Nino Schurter did a training video where he had somebody come in and video him training. And there was a lot of stuff that he was doing that kind of fell into the same category of like, you know, balance training and functional training and you know, these things. And, you know, one of the things that I pointed out was that, you know, one, you don't know where they're at in the training cycle, right? Like you have no clue if 3 months ago he was doing regular deadlifts and bench press and normal stuff. And they're just kind of showing you the fancy stuff that they're doing. And that's, you know, like these plate flips is a perfect example of that. Like you have how much core basic stuff is she doing? I'll bet there's a lot of it, right? Because she's pretty good. But what do you post on Instagram? You post the crazy looking stuff. You post these plate flips. And so, you know, people start to get a disproportionate idea of how much these exercises really play the role they play in your success. The other thing is that pros have all day to train, right? It's their job. And so if you're just trying to fill time, I still wouldn't fill time with something like what I consider to be that risky. But man, sometimes you just have people doing stuff because they have time and they have energy and they want to do stuff. And so you program stuff in. So like the best way to explain it is, you know, I always tell people that if you come to me and you tell me that I got 4 hours a day to train, or you come to me and say I've got 4 hours a week to train, those are going to be completely different training programs. Right. And so a pro is more of that, like, hey, I got 4 hours a day to train. And your average rider, the people that I work with most of the time, are more like, dude, 4 hours a week to train. Where are you getting that? Like, I'm lucky if I've got 2 to 3 hours a week to train. So some of these things are these, you know, fill in the, you know, just kind of fill in the space. And again, like I personally don't think that the risk to benefit ratio for that specific exercise is worth it, especially for a world champion caliber athlete who just takes one one time to miss your balance and fall off and break something and lose a season. It just, that seems ridiculous, right? It's all fun and games until that one time. But, you know, so again, just keep that in mind when you're watching that. But as far as like balance training itself goes, like what value does it have? How could you implement it? You know, my basic take on it after using a lot of different stuff, I've used balance boards, I've used, you know, Swiss balls, you know, a lot of different tools for trying to train balance. And the thing that I've found is that if you have someone who just has a really bad sense of body awareness and a bad sense of just quote unquote balance, because here's the thing, balance is specific to the task at hand, right? Like you get someone who's a really good bike rider and then you put them on a slack line, and yeah, they'll probably do better than your average person, but they're not going to do as good as somebody who's really good on a slack line. And then vice versa, you take someone who's really good on a slack line, put them on a mountain bike, they'll probably do better than your average person, but they're not going to do as good. There's a lot of specific balance that goes into the task at hand. And so, you know, if we're just going to use this general term balance, right, someone just kind of has like bad balance in most situations, then I can certainly see a case for having them do some of their work on unstable surfaces, just trying to build some general body awareness and sense of where you are in space, which is really kind of at the core of your balance. But once you reach a specific, you know, a basic level, like where you have decent balance, I don't think that focusing a lot more on balance training is going to help you, especially because balance is so specific to the task at hand. And so if you think about it, like if you want to improve your balance on the bike, what's the best training tool to improve your balance on the bike? Your bike. Track stands are probably the best balance training tool specific to your bike that you can possibly do. Do regular foot and do switch foot track stands, and that is balance training for your bike. You are learning the specific skill of balancing on your bike. And remember, when you're moving, you have momentum to help you balance. When you're not moving, it's all you balancing. That's why that is a good balance exercise, because you have to learn how to manipulate your weight and the balance points of the bike to achieve balance with no help from momentum whatsoever. And so if you have extra time to spend on balance training, then you should be doing track stands, not more work on BOSU balls and Swiss balls and endo boards and things like that. Man, I watch some stuff. I see some freaking psychos on Instagram. They're like doing front squats on those endo boards. And, you know, those are those, you know, they look like a skateboard deck with a wooden, a wooden rod, big round wooden, you know, dowel or whatever in the middle. And you're balancing on that. And they're doing front squats with hundreds of pounds on these things. And you watch this freaking thing moving around, and it's like, oh my God, if he just loses his balance for a split second, he's done. And this isn't your sport, right? Like, I don't know anyone out there who gets paid based on how much they can squat on an endo board or how many freaking plate flips they can execute while standing on a Swiss ball, right? Like, no one gets paid for that. So the risk to benefit ratio for that is, to me, just not worth it. But so anyways, if you're going to do balance training, you know, a little bit is fine. If you find something you want to do for fun, like, hey, man, you like slack, you get a slack line and you have fun doing the slack line, great. Have fun doing the slack line. Just don't think that going overboard and spending a ton of time slacklining is going to have a really big direct effect on your mountain bike balance. And so that's the my experience and take on it. I have heard that, you know, there are studies out there that have looked at balance training and have shown that the specificness of it, that doing balance training in one area does not transfer over to another area. And, you know, I apologize, I haven't had a chance to track those studies down, but again, from people that I trust, and I've heard them talk about that, but it backs up my own experience as well, and I think most people would probably agree it backs up their experience. So balance training has a place, it's just not a big place, and you really need to weigh the risk to benefit ratio for what you're doing. And a lot of times some of the things that people are doing just don't add up from that point of view. All right, so with that said, we're going to move on to our skills training section, where I wanted to address a problem that I see. It's become a really big problem, and that is the advice to drop your heels on descent and to drop your outside foot on corners. And the problem with this advice is, it's something I talked about on the last podcast. It's, you have to identify the right problem. What's the problem we're trying to solve? And dropping your heel or dropping your outside foot are both working to try to solve a weight problem. You're trying to shift the weight on your pedal back, and you're on a descent, because normally you have a little bit of a front bias. Your toes are pointed down because of the uneven forces of most pedals. This doesn't happen on a catalyst pedal, by the way, because it's designed properly and you have even forces going into the pedal. But when you don't have that, you have uneven forces tipping your foot forward. And so you have a bias of the weight is towards the front of the pedal, which is not good when you're going down a descent and your foot can get tossed off the pedal. And so the advice to drop your heel comes from trying to bias the weight to the back of the pedal. Because if you have the weight on the back of the pedal, then it's harder for your foot to roll off the pedal. It also angles your foot a little bit better so that you're able to absorb the energy from the ground better as well. So that's the rationale behind dropping your heel. And the dropping your foot, outside foot on a corner, is the same, trying to solve the same problem. You're trying to weight that outside foot. You need to get weight on that outside foot so you can drive through it through the corner. And so the problem, though, is that the problem isn't weight. Weight isn't what we're trying to solve. What we're trying to solve on the bike is pressure. And pressure and weight are related, but they're not the same thing. And so what you want to do is not drop anything. You're trying to apply pressure into it, right? So on a descent, what I'm wanting to do is I'm wanting to apply more pressure through the back end of the pedal, right? And so as I shift my hips back, then that weights the back end of my foot more, and then that causes the pedal to drop. So it's my hips shifting that starts to weight the back of the foot more, and that weighting the back of the foot is what allows you to apply pressure effectively into the pedal. If I drop my heels more than I need to, I can't apply pressure effectively into the pedal. Like, there's a relationship between my hips shifting back and my foot position, and then my ability to apply pressure through my foot into the pedal. And so when I just drop my heel, I have basically locked my foot in one position, and my hips are no longer able to, my foot is no longer able to compensate for the position of my hips in order to find the best position to apply pressure into the foot and into the pedal. And so you lock yourself into a bad position. It also puts a ton of stress on your calf and Achilles tendon. You're basically putting yourself in like a calf stretch on a descent, which is not a good thing to do to yourself. And so, again, the idea is not to drop your heel. The idea is to shift your hips back, and that shifting of your hips back weights the heels, which allows you to apply pressure through the foot effectively based on where your hips are. So the more your hips shift back, the more you're going to weight the back of the heels, the more the pedal is going to drop. But again, all of this is in relationship to how much you're shifting your hips back. So if you drop your heels all the way down, but you don't need to shift your weight back, you don't need to shift your hips back very far, you've actually lost the optimal position of your feet for a strong, stable foot position and the ability to apply pressure into the pedal. This is also a reason why the catalyst pedal works better than normal pedals, because you're able to get pressure at both ends of the arch. And so as you shift the weight back, you're actually weighting the back end of the arch instead of just the you know, shifting the weight on the ball of the foot towards the back of the ball of the foot. But anyways, and then same thing with cornering. The same exact thing is happening. You're wanting to shift your hips. You're actually the hips shifting to the outside and weighting the outside crank arm is what the more you're weighting it, the more the crank arm is going to drop. And again, if you just drop the outside crank arm going in and you don't need to shift your hips over very much at all, well, now you have lost the optimal position for applying pressure into that foot. You've also kind of locked your hips into a position where they're not able to move as effectively. And so trying to keep your feet, it's, you know, it's not level, but they're relative with your the ground and they're relative with your hips. And so like the more your hips shift out, the more your foot drops. But again, it's not dropping, it's the hips are weighting the foot. And then that weight allows you to apply pressure into the pedal. And there's a relationship between hip position and foot position and your ability to apply those things properly. And so just having you drop your outside foot going into a corner robs you of those chances to modulate your pressure, right? Because a little bit of pressure, your foot will drop a little bit. A lot of pressure, your foot drops a lot. So if you just drop it all the way down and leave it there, you've actually lost your ability to modulate your pressure into the pedal and into the rear wheel there to maintain traction and get the into corner properly. And so it's really, really bad to focus on dropping the feet. The focus wants to be on shifting the hips, and the hip shifting will weight the feet, and the feet being weighted will dictate how much the pedal is going to drop, either, you know, when you're in a descent or in a corner. And then again, make sure you're maintaining that relationship between your hip and foot position to apply pressure optimally into the pedal. So anyways, get away from the dropping of anything. You want to be applying pressure, and pressure is always that you want to be able to modulate your pressure, and it should be in relation to what you're doing at the time and your body position and all these other things. So just putting your foot in a position, putting your leg in a position, irregardless of where the rest of your body is not the best way to do it. So that's that's the skills training section. The next stuff, next part I wanted to get into is the bro science. And basically, I came across a few studies a while back that looked at the risk of hip injuries for people who ride clipless pedals. And I'll include the link so you can go to this podcast and check out the links. And yes, you can shoot a ton of holes in the studies, right? Like they were just case studies, a lot of them. You know, there were three studies. One of them was a case study on two riders. Another was a case study on five riders. They were all, again, like you can poke a lot of holes in it. But all three studies found the same thing, which is that being clipped in increases your risk for not being able to get unclipped, right? I mean, that makes sense. Like sometimes you're not going to get unclipped, or sometimes it is going to it's going to cost you a fraction of a second. And that fraction of a second can be the difference between you getting your foot down and you not getting your foot down and then just falling onto your hip. And so there is an increase there. That is what the science concluded. And you know, one of the things that they really stressed was, you know, you have to, it's really important that you have your cleats set up properly. And if they're not, then it really increases your risk for these hip injuries. And so, again, if you're going to be riding clipless pedals, you need to be making sure that you're doing that. Now, the thing is, though, is with flat pedals, you don't have either one of those problems, right? Like, you don't have to worry about your foot not coming off when you want it to come off. When you go to take your foot off the pedal, it comes off. And so you're not losing fractions of a second, and it never doesn't not come off, right? You never go to take your foot off and you're like, oh crap, I can't get it off my flat pedal. The other thing is you don't have to worry about having perfect cleat setup. And without having a perfect cleat setup, you're increasing your risk of injury. And so the point is that one of the things that really annoys me in the clipless versus flats debate is that we pretend that clipless pedals don't have very real drawbacks, and that one of their very real drawbacks is that they do increase your risk of injury, period. Like, they do. It's not a matter of opinion. The science backs it up, right? And so they do increase your risk of injury, and especially specific injuries like to the hips, injuries to the head or something that are more common, because if you're going over the handlebars and you can't get unclipped, then taking it on the head is a lot more likely. And so you have a higher risk of injury, and you have a higher risk of injury in different areas than you do with flat pedals. Like, yes, flat pedals have a risk of injury, but they're not the same as clipless pedals. And so, pretending that clipless pedals don't have a very real risk of increasing your injury rate, and that flat pedals are safer from that regard, I think is just dishonest. And again, it annoys me when people get upset. In fact, I'll almost guarantee you I'm going to have some people, have reply, leave a comment, something with this podcast talking about what a jerk I am for bringing this subject up and trying to scare people with, by telling people that, oh, you're going to get hurt from not getting unclipped, and that, that's just part of it, and you just got to deal with it, and you shouldn't talk about it. And it's one of the most ridiculous things ever. So the point with the bro science this week is we got to get away from this, it's just your opinion, dude, right? Like, some things are your opinion, right? Like chocolate or vanilla, right? Blondes or brunettes. That's opinion. There's no objective data that you can point to say, look, we should consider this as well when trying to formulate our decisions. We have science for things in cycling, and cycling loves to ignore science that doesn't back up its narrative. And so here you have three studies that say in the conclusion that not only that clipless pedals increase your risk of hip injury, but there's also unique injuries that you are at a risk of with clipless pedals due to the rotational nature of the forces on the legs sometimes when you're not able to get unclipped. And so you're exposing yourself to a whole different class of injuries that flat pedals don't expose you to. And so, and this isn't just my opinion, bro. This is science. This is objective data. And, mountain biking just seems to be getting taken over. It's always been this way a little bit, especially with the clipless pedal debate, where it's just like, oh, that's just your opinion, man. And it's like, no. There's science to back these up. Like, at that point, it's not just my opinion. There's subjective and there's objective data. And everyone's entitled to their subjective opinion, yes. But when you are just ignoring objective data because it doesn't back up your subjective opinion, man, we're reaching levels of we're actually, I don't know what the word is for that, man. We're going backwards when we're doing that, when we're ignoring science because it doesn't back up what we want it to say. And so that is one of my biggest problems with this whole clipless versus flat pedal debate, is that there is a lot of science out there that says that clipless pedals increase your injury rate, that or increase your injury risk, that they don't increase your power and efficiency. A lot of the things that we're told by the cycling industry that you need clipless pedals for, science says not so fast, my friend. And add that to the increased risk of injury, and it's like, man, the story is starting to change. Give it another 10, 20 years, and I think the whole clipless versus flats debate is going to be much different, because the science can only be ignored for so long, right? And there's also subjective data. I mean, there's people that perform really well on flat pedals. I mean, Sam Hill has won World Cup titles and Enduro World Series titles on flat pedals. So obviously, you're able to beat clipped-in riders on flat pedals. But anyways, anyone who says it's just your opinion that clipless pedals increase your risk of injury, they're wrong, right? No, the science backs it up. So until we've got some science that points in the other direction, that they don't increase your risk of injury due to not being able to get on clip, then this is what we got to go with, right? So anyways, moving on. And speaking of science, the Rider Q&A question. It was a good question. I really enjoyed this guy's question because I had posted something on Instagram and Facebook, a little whiteboard thing that I use to explain to riders. I call it my pedaling. I don't know what to call it really. It's like a posture and effort quadrants, right? So you've got standing and seated on one end of the quadrant, and then you've got high tension and low tension efforts on the other end. And so you can either be standing or seated, and you can either be in low tension or high tension mode, and you put those together and you come up with a quadrant. And so the idea is, I try to really emphasize, like, look, man, standing pedaling, max tension or high tension, that's your max performance zone. You can pedal the fastest, you produce the most power standing up, you're able to execute your skills the most efficiently when you're standing up. So when you're in high tension mode, standing up gives you maximum performance. When you're in low tension mode, standing up lets you use what I call free speed, which is using your techniques and skills to be as efficient as possible on the trail. There's free speed everywhere, right? You can hit the backside of little rollers and pump them, coming out of corners, catching some speed. Like, there is speed all over the trail that doesn't require pedaling to get. You just have to use your skills to mine it, I guess, get that free speed out of the trail. But again, you got to be standing up to do this. When you're in sitting down in low tension, then that's a good time to recover. That's a great position for recovery. When you get to high tension, seated pedaling, it's a terrible thing to do to yourself. It's a terrible position to be in. That's going to be maximum pain, maximum overuse injuries. I call it the adult fetal position. Now, this kind of, you know, again, goes against a lot of what most riders hear, which is that you need to sit down as much as possible. Only stand up when you need to. Sitting down is more efficient. You want to avoid standing up as much as possible. You know, there is the question of whether you need your butt on the seat to have weight on the rear tire for traction, which is not accurate. You need pressure on the back tire, not weight. And you can certainly climb just fine without having your butt on the seat. That has nothing to do with keeping pressure on your back tire. But the point here is more about the effort level, and isn't seated pedaling more efficient? And so you need to be like sitting down as much as possible and only standing up when you absolutely have to. And so I'm sitting here advocating, like, man, you should be standing up like 50% of the time. Like, use free speed. You know, stand up whenever it gets hard. Like, whatever you do, don't just lock down in the adult fetal position and grind your face off up a climb or something like that. It's not good for your body. It's probably not the best, you know, thing to do. And so the question was, well, what about these studies that show that seated pedaling at submaximal efforts are more efficient than standing pedaling? And so again, great question. And my reply was, you know, a couple things you got to look at is that one, the studies that show that are usually looking at seated pedaling versus standing pedaling, not a mix of the two, right? You got to remember, I'm not saying to just go out and stand. I'm saying to use a mix of the two. It's just change your mix. Instead of being like 90%+ seated and less than 10% standing, switch it so that you're like 50, you know, plus percent standing and you know, 50% or less seated. So it's a mix that I'm talking about, not one versus the other. And so if you're just looking at seated pedaling versus standing pedaling at submax efforts, that yeah, you're going to find that seated pedaling is more efficient. In fact, GCN, Global Cycling Network, they did one of their videos a few years ago that actually looked at seated pedaling versus a mix of seated versus standing pedaling, and found that the mix actually outperformed the seated alone. So basically, the over-reliance on one position is not going to be as effective as using both positions to their maximum advantage, right? And so the other thing that you have to look at is that these tests are done in a lab, which is great, but the lab's not the trail. And so there's going to be a lot of times, like especially on technical climbs, where you standing up and using your technique to help get you up and over things and through that climb or through a technical section of trail, I mean, it's going to, I'd argue, is going to be more efficient than sitting down and trying to just pedal your way through everything and out fitness your way through everything and using very little skill and technique. And so, but again, you can't measure that in a lab. And that's one of these differences between road riding and mountain biking is mountain biking, the skill aspect, the efficiency aspect is so important. And so, you know, an over-reliance on that seated pedaling position can take away from your overall performance. You know, and the other thing that I pointed out was that, you know, pro riders, because this question centered around like cross-country pros, like why do cross-country pros sit down so much? And, you know, there's a lot of stuff going on there. They stand up way more than your average rider. You know, their 80% is more than most people's 100%. So you're watching them and they're in low tension mode going really fast because that's what they do. So there's a lot of stuff going on there. But you also have to remember that what pro riders do to reach top performance levels is not always the healthiest thing to do to your body. And that a lot of professional athletes in all sports, especially, you know, cycling included, end up getting, you know, bad overuse injuries, broken down and beaten up from what they're doing. And so a short-term study looking at standing versus seated pedaling is not going to be able to take into account long-term overuse injuries and, you know, negative side effects that happen from sitting down all the time and never standing up. And so again, it's something that you can't really take into account. Now, if you're a professional rider and you're paying your mortgage based on, you know, your performance doing that, maybe that risk to benefit ratio, you know, that's worth it. But most people listening to this aren't. Most people are just riding for fun. Even if you race, you know, you're not paying your bills based on your performance. So you also got to keep in mind the longevity aspect of it. So I don't think that sitting down in over-reliance on that adult fetal position is better. I just think that you got a lot of people that do that and they're really good at doing it. But I, you know, even if it is, I'd still argue that standing up is going to be better for your longevity, which for a lot of people is a more important goal, anyways. And so the take home message from it is that science is great, but it can be misinterpreted and misrepresented. And I think that's what happens with, in this case here, is because people read that sitting down is more efficient at a submax effort. And so they interpret that to mean that I should sit down as much as possible and I should avoid hard efforts because they're inefficient. And that's exactly what ends up happening is people become over-reliant on their seated position. And so, you know, if you want to get better at standing pedaling, you have to practice standing pedaling. And if you never practice standing pedaling, it's always going to be difficult. It's always going to be hard for you to do. And so the over-reliance on that is the problem. Now, I look at that and I say, well, man, that matches up perfectly with what I said, right? Like, seated pedaling is great for recovery. It is more efficient at sub-max efforts. I just think that people need to change their definition of what a max effort is. A max effort doesn't need to be like a red line 100% effort. I consider anything over like an 80% effort, you're getting hard, right? Once you get into the realm of hard, we're getting into the realm of max effort. Now it's a spectrum, right? Of like low max effort versus high max effort. But that's what you want to do. Like that high tension mode is really when you get into that 80% effort range, things are getting hard. You know, yeah, the studies actually say like stand up, like seated pedaling is not more efficient for maximum efforts. So just change your definition of what a max effort is. It's basically when things start to get hard. Stand up when things get hard, sit down and recover when it's easy. And that's the basic thing. And as you practice that, you're going to find that you're able to do that more and more, stand up more. Your definition of what's hard while standing up starts to change. And so, and with that, you're going to find that your trail riding is going to improve so much because, like, again, I watch people ride. I'm living in Fruita. It's awesome. But we have a lot of people coming here to visit. And most people I see on the trails, man, they don't stand up. Like, they will stand up for a second and then their butt's right back down on the seat and they're so reliant. And there's so many features around here. A couple of the particular come to mind that you can't do sitting down, right? To some ledges on climbs that you have to be able to stand up and pedal up to them so that you're in a position to get up and over them. And, you know, if you're trying to sit down and then stand up at the last second because you're not comfortable standing pedaling, you don't spend a lot of time there, and your whole theory is trying to avoid that position like the plague, then it's going to be tough. So yeah, again, the science definitely says that, but what is your interpretation of it? And my interpretation is different than most people's, which, like I said, it kind of backs up what my recommendations are using that quadrant there, the postures and the tension levels or effort levels. So that's it. Man, we got through a lot of info. I'm going to close it out. I do want to ask that if you enjoy the show, to please leave us a rating or a comment on iTunes, or if you're on Podbean, follow us, or whatever your favorite, however you're following the podcast here. That does help other riders find the podcast. So I'd really appreciate your help with that. Also want to remind you to visit bikejames.com, where you can sign up for the free workout of the month and free weekly training tips. You can also find out more about the programs I have to help you improve your power, endurance, and skills. And finally, visit pedalinginnovations.com to learn more about the Catalyst pedal. I designed the Catalyst pedal to be the best performing, most comfortable pedal on the planet. It uses real science and movement principles, and it supports your foot in a unique way that lets you get a true midfoot position so that you have pressure under both ends of the arch. Remember, it's not about pressure under the ball of the foot or pressure under the heel. It's about pressure under both. And then your ability to put more pressure on one end or the other as you need it and the situation dictates. So no one's ever been able to explain to me the argument against heel pressure on your bike. No one's saying to not have pressure on the ball of your foot. I'm just saying that no other sport, no other activity in the world asks you to only have pressure on the ball of your foot all the time. It's just not how the body works. So you want to be able to support the whole foot, have pressure on either end as you need it, which is what the Catalyst pedal does. So you can visit pedalinginnovations.com to learn more about that. Remember, it's got a 30-day money-back guarantee. So if you don't like them, send them back, send your money back. No one else in the bike industry does that. That's how much I believe in the product. So anyways, that's going to do it for this episode of the Bike James Podcast. Hope you guys have enjoyed it. I've had a fun as always, and I will talk to everybody next time.